Why are you so set on software doing it? Because software doesn't get greedy and try to steal, even for a noble purpose. So what if Peter is using Ender's money? That's what you're worried about, right? If we suddenly cut it off, won't he notice? Won't that set back his efforts? Ender saved the world. He's entitled to have his full pension when and if he ever wants it. There are laws to protect child actors. Why not war heroes traveling at light speed? Ah, said Graf. So you are thinking about what will happen when you take off in the scout ship we offered you. I don't need you to manage my money. Petra will do it just fine. I want her to have the use of the money, meaning you think you'll never come back. You're changing the subject. Software. Managing Ender's investments. A semi-autonomous program that... Not semi. Autonomous. There are no autonomous programs. Besides which, the stock market is impossible to model. Nothing that depends on crowd behavior can be accurate over time. What computer could possibly deal with it? I don't know, said Bean. Didn't that mind game you had us play predict human behavior? It's very specialized educational software. Come on, said Bean. It was your shrink. You analyzed the behavior of the kids and... That's right. Listen to yourself. We analyzed. But the game also analyzed. It anticipated our moves. When Ender was playing, it took him places the rest of us never saw. But the game was always ahead of him. That was one cool piece of software. Can't you teach it to play investment manager? Graf looked impatient. I don't know. What does an ancient piece of software have to do with... Bean, do you realize how much effort you're asking me to go to in order to protect Ender's pension? I don't even know that it needs protecting. But you should know that it doesn't. Guilt. You, the conscienceless wonder, are actually using guilt on me. I spent a lot of time with Sister Carlotta. And Petra's no slouch either. I'll look at the program. I'll look at Ender's money. Just out of curiosity, what is the program being used for now that you don't have any kids up there? Graf snorted. We have nothing but kids here. The adults are playing it now. The mind game. Only I promised them never to let the program do analyses on their gameplay. So the program does analyze. It does pre-analysis. Looking for anomalies, surprises. Wait a minute, said Bean. You don't want me to have it run Ender's finances? I haven't changed my mind about that. I'm just wondering, maybe it could look at a really massive database we've got here and analyze, well, find some patterns that we're not seeing. The game was created for a very specific purpose. Pattern finding in databases wasn't... Oh, come on, said Bean. That's all it did. Patterns in our behavior. Just because it assembled the database of our actions on the fly doesn't change the nature of what it was doing. Checking our behavior against the behavior of earlier children. Against our own normal behavior. Seeing just how crazy your educational program was making us. Graf sighed. Have your computer people contact my computer people. With your blessing. Not some foot-dragging, fob-them-off-with-smoke-and-mirrors effort that deliberately leads nowhere. You really care about what we do with Ender's money? I care about Ender. Someday he may need that money. I once made a promise that I'd keep Peter from hurting Ender. Instead, I did nothing while Peter sent Ender away. For Ender's own good. Ender should have had a vote. He did, said Graf. If he had insisted on going home to Earth, I would have let him. But once Valentine came up to join him, he was content. Fine, said Bean. Has he given consent to have his pension pillaged? I'll see about turning the mind game into a financial manager. The program is a complex one. It does a lot of self-programming and self-alteration, so maybe, if we ask it to, it can rewrite its own code in order to become whatever you want it to be. It is magic, after all. This computer stuff. That's what I always thought, said Bean. Like Santa Claus. You adults pretend he doesn't exist, but we know that he really does. When he ended the conversation with Graf, Bean immediately called Ferreira. It was full daylight now, so Ferreira was actually awake. Bean told him about the plan to have the mind game program analyze the impossibly large database of vague and mostly useless information about the movements of pregnant women with low birth weight babies, and Ferreira said he'd get right on it. He said it without enthusiasm, but Bean knew that Ferreira wasn't the kind of man to say he'd do something and not do it, just because he didn't believe in it. He'd keep his word. How do I know that? Bean wondered. How do I know that I can trust Ferreira to go off on wild goose chases once he gives his word to do it? While I know without even knowing that I know it that Peter is partly financing his operations by stealing from Ender. That was bothering me for days before I understood it. Damn, but I'm smart. Smarter than any computer program. Even the mind game. If only I could control it. I may not have the capacity to consciously deal with a vast database and find patterns in it, but I could deal with the database of stuff I observe in the hegemony and what I know about Peter, and without my even asking the question, out pops an answer. Could I always do that? Or is my growing brain giving me ever stronger mental powers? I really should look at some of the mathematical conundrums and see if I can find proofs of whatever it is they can't prove but want to. Maybe Valescu isn't so wrong after all. Maybe a whole world of minds like mine. Miserable, lonely, untrusting minds like mine. Minds that see death looming over them all the time. Minds that know they'll never see their children grow up. Minds that let themselves get sidetracked on issues like taking care of a friend's pension that he'll probably never need. Peter is going to be so furious when he finds out that those pension checks aren't going to him anymore. Should I tell him it was my meddling? Or let him think the IF did it on their own? And what does it say about my character that I am absolutely going to tell him I did it?
Teresa didn't actually see Peter until noon, when she and John Paul and their illustrious son sat down to a lunch of papaya and cheese and sliced sausage. "Why do you always drink that stuff?" asked John Paul. Peter looked surprised. "Guaran. It's my duty as an American to never drink Coke or Pepsi in a country that has an indigenous soft drink. Besides which, I like it." "It's a stimulant," said Teresa. "It fuzzes your brain." "It also makes you fart," said John Paul. "Constantly." "Frequently would be the more accurate term," said Peter. "And it's sweet of you to care." "We're just looking out for your image," said Teresa. "I only fart when I'm alone." "Since he does it in front of us," said John Paul to Teresa, "what exactly does that make us?" "I meant in private," said Peter. "And flatulence from carbonated beverages is odorless." "He thinks it doesn't stink," said John Paul. Peter picked up the glass and drained it. "And you wonder why I don't look forward to these little family get-togethers." "Yes," said Teresa. "Family is so inconvenient for you, except when you can spend their pension checks." Peter looked back and forth between her and John Paul. "You aren't even on a pension, either of you. You're not even 50 yet." Teresa just looked at him like he was stupid. She knew that look drove him crazy. But Peter refused to bite. He simply went back to eating his lunch. His very incuriosity was proof enough to Teresa that he knew exactly what she was talking about. "You mind telling me what this is about?" asked John Paul. "Why, Andrew's pension," said Teresa. Bean thinks that Peter's been stealing it. So naturally, said Peter with his mouth full, Mother believes him. Oh, haven't you then? Asked Teresa. There's a difference between investing and stealing. Not when you invested in hegemony bonds, especially when a circle of huts in Amazonas has a higher bond rating than you. Investing in the future of world peace is a sound investment. Investing in your future, said Teresa, which is more than you did for Andrew. But now that Bean knows, you can be sure that source of funding will dry up very quickly. How sad for Bean, said Peter, since that was what was paying for his and Petra's search. It wasn't until you decided it was, said John Paul. Are you really that petty? If Bean decides unilaterally to cut off a funding source, then I have to reduce spending somewhere. Since spending on his personal quest has nothing to do with hegemony goals, it seems only fair that the meddler's pet project be the first to go. It's all moot anyway. Bean has no claim on Ender's pension. He can't touch it. He's not going to touch it himself, said Teresa. He doesn't want the money. So he'll turn it over to you? What will you do? Keep it in an interest-bearing debit account, the way you do with your own money? Peter laughed. He seems unrepentant, said John Paul. That's the problem with Peter, said Teresa. Only the one, said Peter. Either it doesn't matter or it's the end of the world. No in-between for him. Absolute confidence or utter despair. I haven't despaired in years. Well, weeks. Just tell me, Peter, said Teresa, is there no one you won't exploit to accomplish your purposes? Since my purpose is saving the human race from itself, said Peter, the answer is no. He wiped his mouth and dropped his napkin on his plate. Thanks for the lovely lunch. I do enjoy our little times together. He left. John Paul leaned back in his chair. Well, I think I'll tell Bean that if he needs any next-of-kin signatures for whatever he's doing with Andrew's pension, I'll be happy to help. If I know Julian Delphiki, no help will be needed. Bean saved Peter's whole enterprise by killing Achille at great personal risk, and our son's memory is so short that he'll stop paying for the effort to rescue Bean's and Petra's children. What gene is it that Peter's missing? Gratitude has a very short half-life in most people's hearts, said Teresa. By now, Peter doesn't even remember that he ever felt it toward Bean. Anything we can do about it? Again, my dear, I think we can count on Bean himself. He'll expect retaliation from Peter, and he'll already have a plan. I hope his plan doesn't require appealing to Peter's conscience. Teresa laughed. So did John Paul. It was the saddest kind of laughter in that empty room.
Chapter 10. Grief. From Felix Starman, backdoor at rwanda.gov.rw, to Peter Wiggin, personal at hegemon.gov. Ray, only one question remains. Dear Peter, your arguments have persuaded me. In principle, I am prepared to ratify the Constitution of the Free People of Earth. But in practice, one key issue remains. I have created in Rwanda the most formidable army and air force north of Pretoria and south of Cairo. That is precisely why you regard Rwanda as the key to uniting Africa. But the primary motivation of my troops is patriotism, which cannot help but be tinged with Tutsi tribalism. The principle of civilian control of the military is, shall we say, not as preeminent in their ethos. For me to turn over my troops to a hegemon who happens to be not only white but American by birth would run a grave risk of a coup that would provoke bloodshed in the streets and destabilize the whole region. That is why it is essential that you decide in advance who the commander of my forces will be. There is only one plausible candidate. Many of my men got a good look at Julian Delphiki. Word has spread. He is viewed as something of a god. His record of military genius is respected by my officer corps. His enormous size gives him heroic stature, and his partial African ancestry, which is fortunately visible in his features and coloring, makes him a man that patriotic Rwandans could follow. If you send Bean to me to stand beside me as the man who will assume command of Rwandan forces as they become part of the Free People's Army, then I will ratify and immediately submit the issue to my people in a plebiscite. People who would not vote for a constitution with you at its head will vote for a constitution whose face is that of the giant Julian. Sincerely, Felix.
Verlomi spoke on the cell phone with her contact. All clear? She asked. It's not a trap. They're gone. How bad is it? I'm so sorry. That bad. Verlomi put away the phone and walked from the shelter of the trees into the village. There were bodies lying in the doorway of every house they passed, but Verlomi did not turn to the right hand or the left. They had to make sure they got the key footage first. In the center of the village, the Muslim soldiers had spitted a cow and roasted it over a fire. The bodies of 20 or so Hindu adults surrounded the roasting pit. 10 seconds, said Verlomi. Obediently, the vidman framed the shot and ran the camera for 10 seconds. During the shot, a crow landed but did not eat anything. It merely walked a couple of steps and then flew again. Verlomi wrote her script in her head. The gods send their messengers to sea, and in grief they fly away again. Verlomi walked near the dead and saw that each corpse had a slab of half-cooked bloody meat in its mouth. No bullets had been spent on the dead. Their throats were split and gaping open. Close up, these three, each in turn, 5 seconds each. The vidman did his work. Verlomi did not touch any of the bodies. How many minutes left? Plenty, said the vidman. Then take every one of them, every one. The vidman moved from body to body, taking the digital shots that would soon go out over the nets. Meanwhile, Verlomi now went from house to house. She hoped that there would be at least one person living, someone they could save. But there was no one. In the doorway of the village's largest house, one of Verlomi's men waited for her. "Please do not go in, lady," he said. "I must." "You do not want this in your memory." "Then it is exactly the thing that I must never forget." He bowed his head and moved aside. 4 nails and a crossbeam had served the family as hooks for clothing. The clothing lay in a sodden mass on the floor. Except for the shirts that had been tied around the necks of 4 children, the youngest only a toddler, the eldest perhaps 9, they had been hung up on the hooks to strangle slowly. Across the room lay the bodies of a young couple, a middle-aged couple, and an old woman. They had made the adults in the household watch the children die. "When he is finished by the fire," said Verlomi, "bring him here." "Is there enough light inside, lady?" "Take down a wall." They took it down in minutes, and then light flooded into the dark place. "Start here," she told the vidman, pointing to the adults' bodies. "Pan very slowly, and then pan just a little faster to what they were forced to watch. Hold on all 4 children. Then, when I enter the frame, stay with me, but not so close that you can't see everything I do with the child." "You cannot touch a dead body," said one of her men. "The dead of India are my children," she said. "They cannot make me unclean. Only the ones who murdered them are made filthy. I will explain this to the people who see the vid." The vidman started, but then Verlomi noticed the shadows of the watching soldiers in the frame and made him start over. "It must be a continuous take," she said. "No one will believe it if it is not smooth and continuous." The vidman started again. Slowly he panned. When he had focused on the children for a solid 20 seconds, Verlomi stepped into the frame and knelt before the body of the oldest child. She reached up and touched the lips with her fingers. The men could not help it. They gasped. "Well, let them," thought Verlomi. "So would the people of India. So would the people of the whole world." She stood and took the child in her arms, raising him up. With no tension on the shirt, it came away easily from the nail. She carried him across the room and laid him in the arms of the young father. "O Father of India," she said, loudly enough for the camera, "I lay your child, the hope of your heart, in your arms." She got up and walked slowly back to the children. She knew better than to look to see if the camera was with her. She had to act as if she didn't know the camera were there. Not that anyone would be fooled, but looking toward the camera reminded people that there were other observers. As long as she seemed oblivious of the camera, the viewers would forget that there must be a vidman and would feel as if only they and she and the dead were in this place. She knelt before each child in turn, then rose and freed them from the cruel nails on which they once hung shawls or school bags. When she laid the second child, a girl, beside the young mother, she said, "O mother of the Indian house, here is the daughter who cooked and cleaned beside you. Now your home is permanently washed in the pure blood of the innocent." When she laid the third child, a little girl, across the bodies of the middle-aged couple, she said, "O history of India, have you room for one more small body in your memory? Or are you full of our grief at last? Is this one body at last too many to bear?" When she took the two-year-old boy from his hook, she could not walk with him. She stumbled and fell to her knees and wept and kissed his distorted, blackened face. When she could speak again, she said, "Oh, my child, why did my womb labor to bring you forth only to hear your silence instead of your laughter?" She did not stand again. It would have been too clumsy and mechanical. Instead, she moved forward on her knees across the rough floor, a slow, stately procession, so that each dip and lurch became part of a dance. She propped the little body on the corpse of the old woman.
"Great-grandmother," cried Velomi, "great-grandmother, can't you save me? Can't you help me? Great-grandmother, you are looking at me, but you do nothing. I can't breathe, great-grandmother. You are the old one. It is your place to die before me, great-grandmother. It is my place to walk around your body and anoint you with ghee and water of the holy Ganges. In my little hands, there should have been a fistful of straw to do pranam for you, for my grandparents, for my mother, for my father." Thus she gave voice to the child. Then she put her arm around the shoulder of the old woman and partly raised her body so the camera could see her face. "O little one, now you are in the arms of God as I am. Now the sun will stream upon your face to warm it. Now the Ganges will wash your body. Now fire will purify, and the ashes will flow out into the sea, just as your soul goes home to await another turn of the wheel." Velomi turned to face the camera, then gestured at all the dead. "Here is how I purify myself. In the blood of the martyrs I wash myself. In the stink of death do I find perfume. I love them beyond the grave, and they love me, and make me whole." Then she reached out toward the camera. "Caliph Alai, we knew you out among the stars and planets. You were one of the noble ones then. You were one of the great heroes who acted for the good of all humankind. They must have killed you, Alai. You must be dead before you would let such things happen in your name." She beckoned, and the vidman zoomed in. She knew from experience with this vidman that only her face would be visible. She held herself almost expressionless, for at this distance any kind of expression would look histrionic. "Once you spoke to me in the corridors of that sterile place. You said only one word. Salam, you said. Peace, you said. It filled my heart with joy." She shook her head once, slowly. "Come forth from your hiding place, O Caliph Alai, and own your work. Or if it is not your work, then repudiate it. Join me in grieving for the innocent." Because her hand could not be seen, she flicked with her fingers to tell the vidman to zoom away and include the whole scene again. Now she let her emotions run free.
She wept on her knees, then wailed, then threw herself across the bodies and howled and sobbed. She let it go on for a full minute. The version for Western eyes would have captions over this part, but for Hindus, the whole shocking scene would be allowed to linger, uninterrupted. Verlomi defiling herself upon the bodies of the unwashed dead. But no, no, Verlomi purified by their martyrdom. The people would not be able to look away. Nor would the Muslims who saw it. Some would gloat, but others would be horrified. Mothers would see themselves in her grief. Fathers would see themselves in the corpses of the men who had been unable to save their children. What none of them would hear was the thing she had not said. Not a single threat, not a single curse, only grief and a plea to Khalif Ali. To the world at large, the video would excite pity and horror. The Muslim world would be divided, but the portion that rejoiced at this video would be smaller each time it was shown. And to Ali, it would be a personal challenge. She was laying responsibility for this at his door. He would have to come out of Damascus and take command himself. No more hiding indoors. She had forced his hand. Now to see what he would do.
The video swept around the world, first on the nets, then picked up by broadcast media. High-resolution files were conveniently provided for download. Of course, there were charges that the whole thing was faked, or that Hindus had committed the atrocities. But no one really believed that. It fit too well with the record that Muslims had created for themselves during the Islamic wars that raged in the century and a half before the buggers came. And it was unbelievable to imagine Hindus defiling the dead as these had been defiled. Such atrocities were meant to strike terror in the hearts of the enemy. But Verlomi had taken this one and turned it into something else. Grief, love, resolve, and finally a plea for peace. Never mind that she could have peace whenever she wanted merely by submitting to Muslim rule. The world would understand that complete submission to Islam would not be peace, but the death of India and its replacement by a land of puppets. She had made this so clear in earlier vids that it did not need to be repeated. They tried to keep the vid from Ali, but he refused to let them block what he saw on his own computer. He watched it over and over again. "Wait until we can investigate and see if it's true," said Ivan Lankovsky, the half-Kazakh aide he trusted to be closest to him, to see him when he was not acting the part of Caliph. "I know that it's true," said Ali. "Because you know this Verlomi?" "Because I know the soldiers who claim to be of Islam." He looked at Ivan with tears streaming down his cheeks. "My time in Damascus is done. I am Caliph. I will lead the armies in the field. And men who act this way, I will punish with my own hand." "That is a worthy goal," said Ivan. "But the kind of men who massacred that village in India and nuked Mecca in the last war, they're still out there. That's why your orders are not being obeyed. What makes you think you can reach your armies alive?" "Because I truly am Caliph, and if God wants me to lead his people in righteousness, he will protect me," said Ali.
Chapter 11. African God. From H95TQ0GDY9 at freenet.net. Posted at site shivadaughter.org. Ray, suffering daughter of Shiva, the dragon grieves at the wounds he caused you. May not the dragon and the tiger be lovers and bring forth peace? Or if there is no peace, may not the tiger and the dragon fight together?
Bean and Petra were surprised when Peter came to see them in their little house on the grounds of the hegemony compound. "You honor our humble abode," said Bean.
"I do, don't I?" said Peter with a smile. "The baby's asleep?"
"Sorry you don't get to watch me nurse him," said Petra.
I have good news and bad news.
They waited for him to tell them.
I need you to go back to Rwanda, Julian.
I thought the Rwandan government was with us.
It's not a raid. I need you to take command of the Rwandan military and incorporate it into the hegemony forces.
Petra laughed.
You're kidding. Felix Starman is going to ratify your constitution?
It's hard to believe, but yes, Felix is ambitious the way I'm ambitious. He wants to create something that will outlive him. He knows that the best way for Rwanda to be safe and free is for there to be no armies in the world, and the only way for that to happen is to have a world government that will maintain the liberal values he's created in his Rwanda. Elections, individual rights, the rule of law, universal education, and no corruption.
We've read your constitution, Peter.
He asked for you in particular. His men saw you when you took Falescu. They call you the African giant now.
Darling, said Petra to Bean, you're a god now, like Verlomi.
The question is whether you're woman enough to be married to a god.
I shade my eyes and it keeps me from going blind.
Bean smiled and turned to Peter. Does Felix Starman know how long I'm not expected to live?
No, I regard that as a state secret.
Oh, no. Now we can't tell each other.
How long will you expect me to stay?
Long enough for the Rwandan army to transfer its loyalty to the free people.
To you?
To the free people. I'm not creating a cult of personality here. They have to be committed to the Constitution and to defending the free people who have accepted it.
In practical terms, a date, please.
Until after the plebiscite, at least.
And I can go with him?
Your choice. It's probably safer there than here, but it's a long flight. You can write the Martel essays from anywhere.
Julian, he's leaving it up to us. We're free people now, too.
All right. I'll do it. Now, what's the good news?
That was the good news. The bad news is that we've had a sudden and unexpected shortfall in revenue. It will take months at least to make up what we abruptly stopped receiving. Therefore, we're cutting back on projects that don't contribute directly to the goals of the hegemony.
Petra laughed. You have the cheek to ask us to help you when you're cutting off funding for our search?
You see, you immediately recognized that your search was not contributing.
You're searching too. To find the virus.
If it exists. In all likelihood, Valescu is teasing us and the virus doesn't actually work and hasn't been dispersed.
So you're going to bet the future of the human race on that?
No, I'm not. But without a budget for it, it's beyond our reach. However, it is not beyond the reach of the international fleet.
You're turning it over to them?
I'm turning Valescu over to them. And they're going to continue the research into the virus he developed and where he might have dispersed it, if he did.
The IF can't operate on Earth.
They can if they're acting against an alien threat. If Valescu's virus works, and it's released on Earth, it would create a new species designed to completely replace humanity in a single generation. The hegemon has issued a secret finding that Valescu's virus constitutes an alien invasion, which the IF has kindly agreed to track down and repel for us.
Bean laughed. Well, it seems we think alike.
Really? Oh, you're just flattering me.
I already turned over our search to the Ministry of Colonization. And we both know that Graf is really functioning as a branch of the IF.
Peter regarded him calmly. So you knew I'd have to cut the budget for your search?
I knew that you didn't have the resources, no matter how much budget you have. Ferreira was doing his best, but Coleman has better software.
Well, everything's working out happily for everyone, then, said Peter, standing up to go.
Even for Ender, said Bean.
Your baby's a lucky little boy to have such attentive parents.
And he was out the door.
Valescu looked tired when Bean went to see him. Old. Confinement wasn't good for him. He was not suffering physically, but he seemed to be growing wan as a plant kept in a closet without sun. "Promise me something," said Valescu. "What?" asked Bean. "Something. Anything. Bargain with me." "The one thing you want," said Bean, "you will never have again." "Only because you're vindictive," said Valescu. "Ungrateful. You exist because I made you, and you keep me in this box. It's a good-sized room. It's air-conditioned. Compared to the way you treated my brothers, they were not legally, and now you have my babies hidden away, and a virus with the potential to destroy the human race. Improve it, erase it. How can you be given your freedom again? You combine grandiosity with amorality. Rather like Peter Wiggin, whom you serve so faithfully. He's a little toad." "The word is toady," said Bean. "Yet here you are, visiting me. Could it be that Julian Delphiki, my dear half-nephew, has a problem I could help him with?" "Same questions as before," said Bean. "Same answer," said Valescu. "I have no idea what happened to your missing embryos." Bean sighed. "I thought you might want a chance to square things with me and Petra before you leave this earth." "Oh, come on," said Valescu. "You're threatening me with the death penalty." "No," said Bean. "You're simply leaving Earth. Peter is turning you over to the IF, on the theory that your virus is an alien invasion." "Only if you're an alien invasion," said Valescu. "But I am," said Bean. "I'm the first of a race of short-lived giant geniuses. Think how much larger a population the Earth can sustain when the average age at death is 18. You know, Bean, there's no reason for you to die young." "Really? You have the antidote?" "Nobody needs an antidote to destiny. Death from giantism comes from the strain on your heart, trying to pump so much blood through so many kilometers of arteries and veins. If you get away from gravity, your heart won't be overtaxed and you won't die." "You think I haven't thought of that?" said Bean. "I'll still continue to grow." "So you get large. The IF can build you a really big ship. A colony ship. You can gradually fill it up with your protoplasm and bones. You'd live for years, tied to the walls of the ship like a balloon. An enormous Gulliver. Your wife could come visit you. And if you get too big, well, there's always amputation. You could become a being of pure mind. Fed intravenously, what need would you have of belly and bowels? Eventually, all you really need is your brain and spine, and they need never die. A mind eternally growing." Bean stood up. "Is that what you created me for, Valescu? To be a limbless, crippled monster out in space?" "Silly boy," said Valescu. "To ordinary humans, you already are a monster. Their worst nightmare. The species that will replace them. But to me, you're beautiful. Even tethered to an artificial habitat, even limbless, trunkless, voiceless, you'd be the most beautiful creature alive. And yet you came within one toilet tank lid of killing me and burning my body. I didn't want to go to jail." "Yet here you are," said Bean. "And your next prison is out in space." "I can live like Prospero, refining my arts in solitude." "Prospero had Ariel and Caliban," said Bean. "Don't you understand?" said Valescu. "You're my Caliban, and all your little children They're my aerials. I've spread them over the earth. You'll never find them. Their mothers have been taught well. They'll mate. They'll reproduce before their giantism becomes obvious. Whether my virus works or not, your children are my virus. So that's what Ashiel plotted? Ashiel? Valescu laughed. That bloody-handed little moron. I told him your babies were dead. That's all he wanted. Fool. So they're not dead. All alive. All implanted. By now, perhaps, some of them born, since those with your abilities will be born 2 months premature. You knew that, and didn't tell us? Why should I? The delivery was safe, wasn't it? The baby was mature enough to breathe and function on its own? What else do you know? I know that everything will work out. Julian, look at yourself, man. You escaped at the age of 1, which means that 17 months after conception, you were able to survive without parents. I don't have even the tiniest worry about the health of your babies, and neither should you. They don't need you, because you didn't need anybody. Let them go. Let them replace the old species, bit by bit, over the generations to come. No, said Bean. I love the old species. And I hate what you did to me. Without what I did to you, all you'd be is Nikolai. My brother is a wonderful person. Kind. And very smart. Very smart. But not as smart as you. Would you really trade with him? Would you really like to be as dull-witted as he is compared to you? Whereupon Bean left, having no answer to Valescu's last question.
Chapter 12. Allahu Akbar. From Graf. Pilgrimage at Kalman.gov. 2. Boromakot. Pinto at iKamanan.com. Forwarded and posted by iKamanan. Encrypted using code. Decrypted using code. Ray, Investment Counselor. Your idea of converting the fantasy game software into an investment counselor is going surprisingly well. We haven't had time to do more than short-term testing, but so far it has outpicked all the experts. We are paying Ender's pension funds to it. As you suggested, we are making sure that all investments are under false identities. We are also making sure the software is hooked widely over the nets in endlessly self-varying forms. It will be effectively untraceable and unkillable unless someone is making a systematic international effort to wipe it out, which is unlikely to happen as long as no one suspects it's there. Ender will have no need of this money on his colony, and he'll do a better job if he's not aware that it's there. The first time he enters the nets after his subjective 21st birthday, the software will reveal itself to him along with the extent of his investments. Given the amount of time and travel alone, Ender will come of age with a noticeable fortune. Considerably more, I might add, than even the most optimistic projections of the value of hegemony bonds. But Ender's finances are not an emergency, and your children are. A different team is tweaking the database your Ferreira sent us so it yields us more useful information. It involves a lot of additional research, not by raw data seeks, but by individual operators crawling various medical, voting, tax, real estate, moving company, transportation, and other databases, some of them not legally available. Instead of getting thousands of positives, of which none is likely to be useful, we are now getting hundreds of positives, of which some might actually go somewhere. Sorry it takes time, but once we get a decent positive, we have to check it out, often with landside personnel. And for obvious reasons, we don't have many of those to work with. Meanwhile, I suggest you keep in mind that our deal depends on your making Peter Hegemon, in fact as well as name, before you go. You asked me where my standard of success would be. You can go when Peter has firm control over more than 50% of the world's population, or Peter has sufficient military force that he is assured of victory, whether or not any potential opponent is led by battle school graduates. Therefore, yes, Bean, we expect you to go to Rwanda. We are your best hope for your and your children's survival. And you are our best hope for assuring Peter will prevail and achieve unity and general peace. Your task begins with getting Peter that irresistible military force, and our task begins with finding your babies. Like you, I hope both our tasks turn out to be achievable.
Ali had thought that once he took control of the complex in Damascus, he'd be free to rule as caliph. It didn't take long to learn otherwise. All the men in his palace complex, including his bodyguards, obeyed him implicitly. But as soon as he tried to leave, even to ride around in Damascus, those he trusted most would begin to plead with him. "It's not safe," Ivan Lankovsky would say. "When you got rid of the people controlling you here, it panicked their friends, and their friends included those who are commanding our armies everywhere." "They followed my plan in the war," said Ali. "I thought they were loyal to the caliph." "They were loyal to victory," said Ivan. "Your plan was brilliant, and you were in Ender's Jish, his closest friend. Of course they followed your plan. So they believed in me from battle school, but not as caliph." "They believe in you as caliph," said Ivan, "but more as the figurehead kind of caliph who makes vague religious pronouncements and encouraging speeches, while you have wazirs and warlords to do all the nasty, tedious work, like making decisions and giving commands." "How far does their control reach?" asked Ali. "It's impossible to know," said Ivan. "Here in Damascus, your loyal servants have caught and eliminated several dozen agents. But I would not let you board an aircraft in Damascus, military or commercial. So, if I can't trust Muslims, drive me over the Golan Heights into Israel, and let me fly on an Israeli jet. The same group that refuses to obey you in India is also saying that our accommodation with the Zionists was an offense against God. They want to start that nightmare all over again. They long for the good old days. Yes, when Muslim armies were humiliated left and right, and the world feared Muslims because so many innocents were murdered in the name of God." "You don't have to argue with me," said Ivan pleasantly. "Well, Ivan," said Ali, "if I stay here, then someday my enemies will finish in India. Either they'll win or they'll lose. Either way, they'll come here, made mad by victory or by defeat. It doesn't matter which. Either way, I'll be dead, don't you think?" "Oh, definitely, sir. We do have to find a way to get you out of here."
"No plan?"
"All kinds of plans," said Ivan. "But they all involve saving your life, not saving the caliphate. If I run away, then the caliphate is lost. And if you stay, then the caliphate is yours until the day you die." Ali laughed. "Well, Ivan, you've analyzed it well. So I have no choice. I have to go to my enemies and destroy them." "I suggest you use a magic carpet," said Ivan, "as the most reliable form of transportation. You think only a genie could get me to India to face General Rajam?" "Alive, yes." "Then I must contact my genie," said Ali. "Is this a good time?" asked Ivan. "With the mad woman's latest vid all over the nets and the media, Rajam is going to be a crazy man."
"That's the best time," said Ali. "By the way, Ivan, can you tell me why Rajam's nickname is Andari?
Would it help if I told you that he chose the nickname Thick Rope himself?"
"Ah, so it doesn't refer to his tenacity or strength. He would say it does, or at least the tenacity of a particular part of his body. And yet, rope is limp. Thick rope isn't. Thick rope is as limp as any other, said Ali, unless it's very short. Ivan laughed.
I'll make sure to repeat this joke at Rajam's funeral.
Just don't repeat it at mine.
I will not be at your funeral, said Ivan, unless it's a mass grave.
Ali went to his computer and began to compose a few emails. Within a half hour of sending them, he received a telephone call from Felix Starman of Rwanda. I'm sorry to tell you, said Felix, that I cannot allow Muslim teachers into Rwanda. Fortunately, said Ali, that isn't why I called.
Excellent, said Felix.
I am calling in the interest of world peace, and I understand you have already made your decision about who is the best hope of humankind for achieving that goal. No, say no names.
Since I have no idea what you're talking about,
excellent, said Ali. A good Muslim always assumes that unbelievers have no idea. They both laughed. All I ask is that you let it be known that there is a man crossing the Rub al-Khali on foot because his camel won't let him mount and ride.
And you wish someone to help this poor wanderer?
God watches over all his creatures, but the caliph cannot always reach out a hand to do God's will.
I hope this poor unfortunate will be helped as soon as possible, said Felix.
Let it be soon. I am ready at any time to hear good news of him.
They said their goodbyes, and Ali got up and went in search of Ivan.
Pack, he said.
Ivan raised his eyebrows. What will you need?
Clean underwear, my most flamboyantly caliph-like costume, 3 men who will kill at my command and will not turn their weapons on me, and a loyal man with a video camera with a fully charged battery and plenty of film.
Should the vidman be one of the loyal soldiers or a separate person?
Let all the loyal soldiers be part of the video crew.
And shall I be one of these 3?
That is for you to decide, said Ali. If I fail, the men who are with me will surely die.
Better to die quickly before the face of God's servant than slowly at the hands of God's enemies, said Ivan.
My favorite Russian, said Ali.
I'm a Kazakh Turk, Ivan reminded him.
God was good to send you to me,
and good when he gave you to all of the faithful.
Will you say so when I have done all that I mean to do?
Always, said Ivan. Always, I am your faithful servant.
You are a servant only to God, said Ali.
To me, you are a friend.
An hour later, Ali received an email that he knew was from Petra, despite the innocent signature. It was a request that he pray for a child that was undergoing an operation at the largest hospital in Beirut at 7 o'clock the next morning. We will begin our own prayers at 5 in the morning, said the letter, so that dawn will find us praying. Ali merely answered, I will pray for your nephew and for all those who love him, that he may live. Let it be as God wills, and we will rejoice in his wisdom.
So he would have to go to Beirut. Well, the drive was easy enough. The problem was doing it without alarming anyone that his enemies had set to spy on him. When he left the palace complex, it was in a garbage truck. Ivan had protested, but Ali told him, A caliph who is afraid to be filthied on God's errand is unworthy to rule. He was sure this would be written down, and if he lived, would be included in a book of the wisdom of Caliph Ali, a book he hoped would be long and worth reading, instead of brief and embarrassing. Dressed as a pious old woman, Ali rode in the back seat of a little old sedan driven by a soldier in civilian clothes and a false beard much longer than his real one. If he lost, if he was killed, then the fact that he dressed this way would be taken as proof that he was never worthy to be caliph.
But if he won, it would be part of the legend of his cleverness. The old woman accepted a wheelchair to take her into the hospital, pushed by the bearded man who had driven her to Beirut. On the roof, three men with ordinary scuffed suitcases were waiting. It was 5:10. If someone in the hospital had noticed the disappearance of the old woman, or looked for the wheelchair, or wondered about the three men who had arrived separately, each carrying clothing for a family member to wear home, then word might already have gone out to Eli's enemies. If someone came to investigate, and they had to kill him, it would be as good as setting off an alarm by Rajam's own bed. 5:03, two young doctors, a man and a woman, came onto the roof ostensibly to smoke. But soon they withdrew out of the sight of the men waiting with their suitcases. Ivan looked at Eli questioningly. Eli shook his head. "They are here to kiss," he said. "They are afraid of us reporting them, that's all." Ivan, being careful, got up and walked to where he could see them. He came back and sat down. "More than kissing," he whispered. "They should not do that if they aren't married," said Eli. "Why do people always think that the only two choices are either to follow the harshest Sharia or else discard all the laws of God?" "You have never been in love," said Ivan. "You think not," said Eli. "Just because I can't meet any women does not mean I haven't loved." "With your mind," said Ivan. "But I happen to know that with your body you have been pure." "Of course I am pure," said Eli. "I'm not married." A medical chopper approached. It was exactly 5:00. When it came close enough, Eli could see that it was from an Israeli hospital. "Do Israeli doctors send patients to Beirut?" asked Eli. "Lebanese doctors send patients to Israel," said Ivan. "So, must we expect that our friends will wait until this chopper leaves, or are these our friends?" "You have hidden in garbage and dressed as a woman," said Ivan. "What is riding in a Zionist helicopter compared to that?" The chopper landed. The door opened. Nobody got out. Eli picked up the suitcase that he knew was his because it was light, filled only with clothes instead of weaponry, and walked boldly to the door. "Am I the passenger you came for?" The pilot nodded. Eli turned to look back toward where the couple had gone to kiss. He saw a flurry of motion. They had seen. They would speak of it. He turned back to the pilot. "Can this chopper carry all 5 of us?" "Easily," said the pilot. "What about 7? The pilot shrugged. "We fly lower, slower, but we often do." Eli turned to Ivan. "Please invite our young lovers to come with us." Then Eli climbed into the helicopter. In moments he had the women's clothing off. Underneath he was wearing a simple Western business suit. In moments a pair of terrified doctors climbed into the helicopter at gunpoint, in various stages of déshabille. Apparently they had been warned to maintain absolute silence, because when they saw Eli and recognized him, the man went white, and the woman began to weep while trying to refasten her clothing. Eli came and knelt in front of her. "Daughter of God," he said, "I am not concerned about your immodesty. I am concerned that the man you offered your nakedness to is not your husband." "We will be married," she said. "Then when that happy day comes," said Eli, "your nakedness will bless your husband, and his nakedness will belong to you. Until then, I have this clothing for you." He handed her the costume he had worn. "I do not ask that you dress like this all the time, but today, when God has seen how your heart intended to sin, perhaps you might cover yourself in humility." "Can she wait to dress until we're in the air?" asked the pilot. "Of course," said Eli. "Everybody strap down," said the pilot. There weren't enough seats along the sides. The center was meant to hold a gurney. But Eli's driver grinned and insisted on standing. "I've ridden choppers into battle," If I can't keep my feet in a medical chopper, I deserve some bruises. The chopper tilted as it rose into the air, but soon it found a workable equilibrium, and the woman unstrapped and awkwardly dressed herself. All the men looked away, except her companion, who helped her. Meanwhile, Ali and the pilot conversed, making no attempt to lower their voices. "I don't want these two with us for the main enterprise," said Ali, "but I don't want to kill them either. They need time to find their way back to God." "They can be held in Haifa," said the pilot, "or I can have them taken on to Malta, if that would suit you better." "Haifa will do." It wasn't a long journey, even flying low and slow. By the time they arrived, the doctors were quiet and looked penitent, holding hands and trying not to look at Ali too much. They landed on the roof of a hospital in Haifa, and the pilot turned off the engine and got out to converse for a moment with a man dressed like a doctor. Then he opened the door. "I have to lift off again," he said, "to make room for your transportation. So you need to come out now, except those two." The doctors looked at each other, frightened. "They'll be safe?" asked Ali. "Better if they don't see your transportation come and go," said the pilot. "It will soon be dawn, and there's a little light, but they'll be safe." Ali touched them both as he left the chopper. He and his men watched as the medical chopper lifted off. Instantly, another chopper arrived, but this time a long-range battle jet, large enough to carry many soldiers into battle, and armed heavily enough to get them past a lot of obstacles. The door opened, and Peter Wiggin stepped out. Ali walked up to him. "Salam," he said. "And in you too, let there be peace," said Peter. "You look more like Ender than the public photographs show." "I have them retouched by computer to make me look older and smarter," said Peter. Ali grinned. "It was nice of you to give us a ride." When Felix told me the sad story of that lonely pedestrian in the empty quarter, I couldn't pass up the chance to help. "I thought it would be Bean," said Ali. "It's a whole bunch of men trained by Bean," said Peter. "But Bean himself is on another errand, in Rwanda, as it happens." "So that's happening now?" asked Ali. "Oh, no," said Peter. "We won't make a move until we see how your little adventure turns out." "Then let's go," said Ali. Peter invited Ali to take precedence, but then he himself entered before any of Ali's soldiers. Ivan made as if to protest, but Ali gestured for him to relax. Ali had already bet everything on Peter's being cooperative and trustworthy. Now was not the time to worry about assassination or kidnapping. Even though there were 20 hegemony soldiers already inside, as well as a sizable amount of equipment. Ali recognized the Thai-looking commander as someone he knew from battle school. Had to be Suriyawang. Ali nodded to him. Suriyawang nodded back. Once they were underway and on jet power, this time without any embarrassed woman having to be officially rebuked and forgiven and dressed, Peter indicated the men who were with him. "I assumed," said Peter, "that the lone hitchhiker our mutual friend told me about didn't need a large escort. Only enough to get me to where a certain thick rope is coiled like a snake." Peter nodded. "I have friends currently trying to find his exact location." Ali smiled. "I assume it's far from the front." "If he's in Hyderabad," said Peter, "then he will be under extremely heavy guard. But if he's across the border in Pakistan, security will not be unusually heavy." "Either way," said Ali, "I will not have your men exposed to danger." "Or observed," said Peter. "It wouldn't do for too many people to know you were brought to real power with the help of the hegemon." "You do seem to be at hand whenever I make a play for power." "This is the last time, if you win," said Peter. "This is the last time. Either way," said Ali, then grinned. "Either the soldiers will follow me, or they won't." "They will," said Peter, "if they get the chance." Ali indicated his small escort. "That's what my camera crew is here to ensure." Ivan smiled and lifted his shirt enough to show that he was wearing a bulletproof vest and carrying grenades and clips and a machine pistol.
"Oh," said Peter, "I thought you had gained weight."
"We battle school boys," said Eli. "We always have a plan." "You're not going to fight your way in, then."
"We're going to walk in as if we expected to be obeyed," said Eli, "with cameras rolling. It's a simple plan, but it doesn't have to work for very long. That thick rope, it always did love a camera."
"A vain and brutal man, my sources say," said Peter. "And not stupid."
"We'll see," said Eli.
"I think you're going to succeed," said Peter.
"So do I."
"And when you do," said Peter, "I think you're going to do something about the things Virlomi has been complaining about."
"It's because of those things that I could not wait for a more opportune time. I must wash Islam clean of this bloody stain."
"I believe that with you as caliph, the free people of Earth can coexist with a united Islam," said Peter.
"I believe so as well," said Eli, "though I can never say so."
"But what I want," said Peter, "is insurance that I can use in case you don't survive. Either today or at some future point, I want to make sure I don't have to face a caliph I can't coexist with." Peter handed Eli a couple of sheets of paper. It was a script. Eli began to read. "If you die a natural death and pass on your throne to someone you have chosen, then I'll have no need of this," said Peter. "But if you were murdered or kidnapped or exiled or otherwise dethroned by force, then I want this."
"And what if you are killed or otherwise forcibly removed from office?" asked Eli.
"What happens to this vid then, assuming I say these things for the camera?"
"Try to encourage your followers not to think that killing me would be good for Islam," said Peter. "And my soldiers and doctors will guard against any other possible causes of my untimely death."
"In other words, I just have to risk it," said Eli.
"Come now," said Peter. "The only way this vid will be useful is if you aren't around to repudiate it. And if I'm dead, it will have no value to my unworthy successor."
Eli nodded.
"True enough."
He stood up, opened his suitcase, and dressed in the flamboyant costume of a caliph as the Muslim people expected to see him. Meanwhile, Peter's vidman set up his equipment and the backdrop so it wouldn't be obvious it was taped on a battlecraft surrounded by soldiers. At the gate of the heavily guarded military complex at Hyderabad, once the headquarters of the Indian military, then of the Chinese occupiers, and now of the Pakistani liberators, three motorcycles pulled up, two of them carrying two men each, and the third a single rider with a satchel on the seat behind him. They stopped well back from the gate, so no one would suppose it was an attempt at a suicide bombing. They all held up their hands so some trigger-happy guard wouldn't take a shot at them, while one of the men pulled a video camera out of the satchel and fitted a satellite feed to the top of it. That got the attention of the guards, who immediately phoned for advice from someone in authority. Only when the camera was ready did the man who had been alone on his cycle peel back the traveling coat that had covered him. The guards were almost blinded by the whiteness of his robes, and long before he had his kaffia cloth and agal rope in place on his head. Even the guards who weren't close enough to recognize him by face guessed from the clothing and from the fact that he was a young black man that their caliph had come to see them. None of the common soldiers and few of the officers suspected that General Rajam would not be happy to have a visit from the caliph. So they raised their voices in cheers, some of them in an ululation meant to suggest the cries of Arab warriors riding into battle, though all the soldiers here were Pakistani. The camera rolled as Eli raised his arms to receive the adulation of his people. He strode through the checkpoint unmolested. Someone brought him a jeep, but he refused and kept walking. But the vidman and his crew got into the jeep and rode along beside and then ahead of the caliph. while the caliph's aide, Ivan Lankovsky, dressed in civilian clothes like the vidcrew, explained to the officers who trotted alongside him that the caliph was here to bestow upon General Rajam the honors he had earned. He expected General Rajam and those men he wished to have share this honor greet the caliph in the open square before all of the caliph's soldiers. This word quickly spread, and before long, Ali's progress was accompanied by thousands of uniformed soldiers cheering and calling his name. They kept the path clear for the vidcrew, and those who thought they might be within line of sight of the camera made an especially exuberant show of their love for the caliph, in case someone from home was watching and might recognize them. Ali was reasonably confident that whatever Rajam might be planning, he wouldn't do it in front of a live satellite feed, with thousands of soldiers looking on. Rajam would have had Ali die in a plane crash on the way, or be assassinated somewhere far from Rajam himself. Now that he was here, Rajam would play a waiting game, to see what Ali was up to, meanwhile looking for some innocent-seeming way for Ali to be gotten rid of, killed or trundled back to Damascus and kept under closer guard. As Ali expected, Rajam waited for him at the top of the imposing stairs leading up to the finest-looking building in the compound. But Ali walked up only a few steps and stopped, turning his back on Rajam and facing the soldiers and the camera. The light was good here. The vidcrew took their places at the bottom of the steps. Ali held up his arms for silence and waited. The shouting died down. "Soldiers of God!" he shouted. A huge roar, but it subsided at once. "Where is the general who has led you?" Another cheer, but one that was noticeably less enthusiastic. Ali hoped that Rajam wouldn't be too resentful of the difference in their popularity. Ali did not look. He counted on Ivan to signal him when Rajam was near. He saw Ivan beckoning to Rajam to take his place at Ali's left hand, directly in front of the camera. Ivan signaled. Ali turned and embraced and kissed Rajam. "Stab me to death right now," Ali wanted to say, "because this is your last chance, you treasonous, murdering dog." Instead, he spoke softly into Rajam's ear. "As my old friend Ender Wiggin used to say, Rajam, the enemy's gate is down." Then he let go of the embrace, ignoring the puzzled look on Rajam's face, and took his hand, offering him to the cheering of the soldiers.